Blood on the Tracks is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis.
John Lennon was a musical genius and one of the most beloved cultural figures of the 20th century. His songs inspired dreamers to imagine. His search for the truth gave power to the people. But some thought he dreamed too much. Others thought he was too powerful. So he was followed. He was threatened. He was declared a danger to the United States. And in 1980, he was assassinated. This is his story, told by his so-called friends.
This is Special Agent Jim Steele with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, working case number 009-08-0491. Case subject is Lennon John Winston Ono. This information pertains to a period ending December 1980. Interview subject is Jones David Robert, a.k.a. David Bowie. Interview number 9-93-084-01. Recall number 2, December 22nd, 1980.
John was the only Beatle I got to know. Unfortunately, it was near the end of his life. It must have been 1975-ish. Young Americans. It was one of those associations that lasted about the length of the recording sessions. And then we didn't see each other for about a year. But when we did reconnect, we started to pick up on what was quickly becoming a very instructive and deep relationship. He was from an art school, and a lot of our conversations were about the world of the arts and why an artist wants to do things in the first place. Very dramatic and philosophical 2 o'clock in the morning conversations, that sort of thing. He would rifle through the avant-garde, look for ideas that were on the outside, on the periphery of the mainstream. Then he'd apply those ideas in a functional manner to something that was considered populist and make it work. He'd take the oldest idea and make it work for the masses. That was like making art work for the people, not for the elite. And the people responded. Some with adoration, humility. And then there were those who thought that John was the elitist, that he was bamboozling them. And the response of those people, of one person in particular, well, that's the reason why there's so much blood on the tracks.
Chapter 7, John Lennon and David Bowie.
...1975 was a monumental year for me. It's perhaps the most important year in my professional life. Many people don't know this, you see. Most people think I had my act together from day one, that it was all calculated, that I morphed and evolved with ease. Major Tom to Ziggy Stardust, Ziggy Stardust to a lad insane. But I was winging it. I was making chance look calculated. What is it they say in America? Fake it till you make it, right? By 1975, I couldn't keep faking, I had to make it. So that year, everything changed. And it changed because I met John Lennon.
Unfortunately, it was near the end of his life.
John Lennon took one look at me and knew I had something to give. I had to tear it all down, start over. So I killed Ziggy Stardust. And I drew the curtain on Aladdin's Sane. But the best lesson John gave me, it wasn't just about the music or the character I was playing. It was about the business of art and the people I was working with.
Very instructive.
John looked me dead in the eyes and said, "You're being shafted by your present manager." He was talking about my manager, Tony Dufree, of course. Main man management. My relationship with Tony had deteriorated over the years. I had become increasingly concerned that I was being taken advantage of. John knew all about these sorts of concerns and paranoias. After all that business with the Beatles and Alan Klein.
Very dramatic and philosophical.
And it was just a month earlier, in December of 1974, that the Beatles officially dissolved, each of them untangling himself from the acrimonious web that Alan Klein had spun.
Derek, is it true? Are the Beatles really finished?
No, not until they die. As long as they live and as long as they like each other, anything can happen.
And so John saw Tony's stranglehold on my career as unhealthy, naturally. He opened my eyes to the fact that it wasn't just Tony, you see, it was the concept of managers in general. It's too much power for one person. In John's eyes, there was no such thing as good management. All management was shit. Why have one person control every aspect of my career when I could simply employ individuals as needed to help me with specific wants? Well, that was the question.
2 o'clock in the morning conversations.
John had been through all that. He was wise. He was like an older brother, really. He completely changed my perspective on the business of art. And then we made a song out of the whole ordeal. It was a middle finger of a song that was directed not just at people like Tony Dufresne and Alan Klein, but at the antiquated notion that an artist must be controlled by someone with business sense. And we arrived at that song entirely by chance. It was January, 1975. I was in New York City, Electric Lady Studios. Sessions had resumed for my new album, Young Americans. I'd been introduced to John not long before, I believe, in Los Angeles by Elizabeth Taylor, of all people. She was trying to get me to star in a movie with her, God bless.
John was the only Beatle I got to know.
That's another story entirely. I knew that John lived in New York, so I reached out to him. I told him I was planning to record a cover of Across the Universe, that beautiful song of his from Let It Be. I asked if he wanted to come by the studio and play on the track. It was during the session for Across the Universe that we hit upon this other song by chance. My guitarist, Carlos Alomar, was fooling around with this old R&B riff. I think it was called Foot Stomping, one of the riffs he perfected when he played with James Brown. But he slowed it down, made it something new. I had him keep playing it, repeating it, and before I knew it, John was shouting "aim" in this falsetto hook over the guitar. And that's how fame began. Completely organic, out of thin air.
He would rifle through the avant-garde.
Of course, it wasn't out of thin air. I know that now.
Ideas that were on the outside.
We'd been talking about bad managers and bad business deals and the whole bloody concept of being famous, John and I. Those conversations, along with my changed perspective on what became my new reality as an artist and a businessman, that was all fuel that went into the creative engine.
Apply those ideas in a functional manner.
Carlos was the perfect collaborator. Like I said, he played with James Brown back in the late 60s, and so he had his own personal history with this sort of controlling figure that John and I wanted to rail against. He left James Brown after James docked his paycheck for missing one of his musical cues. Carlos said, "Fuck this, I'm gone." Well, that's fame. Fuck this, we're gone.
That was like making art work for the people, not for the elite.
Because what is fame, after all? What's it good for? A good seat in a restaurant, that's about it. People who don't have fame are the ones who want it. People who have fame are always looking for a way to get rid of it. It's worth noting that a half year after we released Fame, James Brown himself borrowed Carlos's lick for his song Hot, I Need to Be Loved, Love, Love, Love. Not that Carlos ever saw a dime off that. As far as the song Fame goes, this would prove to be my first number one hit in America.
And the people responded.
It also redefined who John was as an artist. Fame saved him from becoming some old-time rock and roll nostalgia peddler and lifted him into the upper echelon of the New York City avant-garde.
You take the honest idea and make it work for the masses.
That moment in time, the song, the session, the wisdom I gleaned from John, that was my turning point. I took the young American's masters and I locked them in a bank vault. I didn't want Tony Dufresne touching them. And then I told RCA that I wanted to go separate ways with Tony and that I needed their complete support, which I got.
And the people responded.
You know what RCA said to Tony when they asked him why they were siding with me over him in the split? Because, Tony, they said, you can't sing. The details of my settlement with Tony have been and will always be confidential, you see. But everything that lay ahead for me, station to station, low, heroes, lodger, scary monsters, that was all made with an autonomy and a confidence that I never would have had if it were not for John Lennon.
Very instructive and deep relationship.
Now, unbeknownst to me, John was continuing to struggle with his own concept of fame. How fame affected every single aspect of his life, even in New York City, where he could walk down the street and remain relatively unbothered. Fame got to him. It got to others close to him. And like the song says, fame can take you over, drive you to crime, and even make you the target of others. One very tangible thing that fame almost always leads to is cocaine. My own daily diet around 1975 was coffee, 4 packs of Gitanes, bell peppers, milk straight from the carton, and cocaine. John and I shared an affinity for this stuff. It's funny, you get access to all these drugs when you become famous, but then it begins to feel as if the reason you're taking the drugs is to forget the fact that you are famous. Cocaine helped me cope. It helped me disappear into whatever role I was playing at the time. It helped me to adjust to the increased pressures, the non-stop schedules, the attention.
On the periphery of the mainstream.
And then when you get used to the pressures and schedules and attention, you don't want it anymore. Any of that. That's when cocaine comes in handy once again. When it's lonely at the top.
Going up for the elite.
Drugs make you forget that you're famous. The fact that you have the very thing you thought you wanted, only to find it's not at all how you imagined it would be. Personally, I was entering into what the medical community would probably refer to as cocaine psychosis around this time. Not that I knew what that was or that I was experiencing it. I think I called Hitler the world's first rock star. Said that I love fascism.
So why an artist wants to do things.
I seriously thought that one of my business advisors was secretly a CIA agent and that one of my backing singers was actually a vampire. John's crash course in how to take control of my career was invaluable, but I still didn't have control over myself. And John had no control over himself either. Now in 1975, John had a lot to be happy about. He had a brand new son, Sean, who stole his heart.
Adoration.
His fight against the United States had come to a positive conclusion, which would directly lead to his green card and citizenship.
Humility.
But good news doesn't tame the beast. You don't walk into a hotel room, stock to the gill with cocaine and champagne and think, no, you know what, I've got a new son, a new lease on life, I'll pass. No, you say, I'm up. I've gone next.
2 o'clock in the morning.
And then you roll up a dollar bill and you make it count. When faced with a party, John partied just as hard as the rest of us. He went as hard as some of the notorious figures who didn't survive the party.
He was from an art school.
But it could have been any of us who didn't survive the party. That could have been John Lennon in Bonzo's shoes, right? Fate rolled the dice. And fate decided that Bonham would be the one who left the proverbial building. Before that happened, however, the two Johns found themselves in the same room. In the same way. both equally tempting fate. In 1976, John and his friend Jesse Ed Davis, the guitarist who was so great in Taj Mahal's band, walked into Led Zeppelin's hotel suite at the Plaza in New York, only to find the greatest rock drummer in the world up to his sinus cavity in heroin.
1975-ish.
Well, technically when John arrived, Bonham was on his knees, hands desperately clutching the cold, damp toilet, absolutely puking his guts out. John had found himself in similar positions throughout his life, though he didn't have the same Herculean stamina as Bonham. Bonham was a heavyweight in that regard. A man who could take 3, 4, even 5 times more than what the average rock star could take before he found himself praying to a porcelain god.
On the outside.
Bonham had been doing China White that night. China White was no joke. It was Bonham grade junk. 40 to 50% pure rather than the usual 10% pure smack you'd find on the streets, but even for Bonham, it proved to be too much. Every time he'd snort the stuff, he'd be back puking into the toilet. The fact that one of rock and roll's most undefeated imbibers was having a rough go of it didn't faze John, though, one bit.
Apply those ideas in a functional manner.
John thought himself invincible, which is another side effect of fame. And no sooner did he snort a Bonham-sized snort of China White that he, too, was on his knees, pushing Bonham out of the way. The two Johns, sick as dogs in Zeppelin's suite at the Plaza, were fighting for air and jockeying for position at the toilet.
Very instructive and deep relationship.
They made it through that moment, and through the night. Bonzo probably walked out of that room and played a show at Madison Square Garden in front of thousands. He wouldn't always be that lucky. That lifestyle caught up with him in the end. Nearly caught up with me too. Christ, I was seeing things, imagining things, believing things that weren't to be believed.
The avant-garde.
One thing I still believe is that there is an evil in this world. And I'm not talking about shady managers. You don't need to be in cocaine psychosis to know that evil walks among us. An evil is what would eventually catch up to John, long before his rock and roll lifestyle ever could.
We'll be right back after this
word.
It was the summer of 1977 when I ran into John again. Hong Kong. Why I was in Hong Kong, I can't quite remember. Was I on holiday? Touring? Maybe I was touring with Eggy, actually. That tour we did for The Idiot, his first solo record I produced after the Stooges broke up. I can't recall, that's not important. But John was there, too, it turns out. In Hong Kong. Vacationing with his son, Sean, who was only a few years old at the time. They'd stopped to explore the city for a few days before their meet-up with Yoko in Japan. And so we quickly picked up where we'd left off and bonded over being two Englishmen in Hong Kong.
We started to pick up.
John continued to teach me so much without even trying to teach me. I don't even know that he realised what he was doing. But he was continuing to give me free lessons in fame. We'd be walking down the street and someone would stop us and say to John, "Excuse me, but aren't you John Lennon?" And John would give them this confused look, absolutely straight-faced, like he'd never received that question before in his life and never in a million years expected to.
Very dramatic.
And then he'd say, "No, I'm not John Lennon, but I wish I had his money." And then the person asking if John was John would realise, well, shit, of course it wasn't John. It was like John had this mind control to make a person doubt their own belief with mere words. So of course I stole that line. It was just too good. It deflected any and all unwanted attention you received out in public. And I swear to God that this happened just months later in New York City. I was walking down the street, Soho, I believe.
1975-ish.
When someone passed me by and shouted, "Aren't you David Bowie?" To which I gave the reply, "Well, no, but I wish I had his money." "You lying bastard," the voice shot back at me. "You wish you had my money." I thought, wait a minute, I know that voice. So I looked up. Bloody hell, it was John. Honest to God. But back in Hong Kong, things got weird more often than not.
The avant-garde.
We had fame to thank for that, not the song, but the fact that we were famous. Because as much as we like to actively try to disassociate ourselves from the spotlight, fame gave us opportunity. Like the opportunity to be in Hong Kong at that moment. John would dote on Sean during the day, show him the sights. At night, he'd often leave him with a nanny who was travelling with them. And then John and I would go and get rip-roaring drunk. Obnoxiously drunk, really.
In a functional manner.
The kind of drunk you get in public only when you're famous. Because the fame or the money, whatever it is, it provides a safety net. Or an illusion of a safety net. And what's the worst thing is going to happen? We get tossed out of a strip club for being too rowdy. This was 1977.
It must have been 1975-ish.
It's not like we're going to lose our jobs because of some drunken shenanigans. We weren't going to cease being famous. Now, had we known we were being tossed out of strip clubs by members of Triad gangs, maybe we would have minded our manners a bit more. But you're most oblivious to the world around you when you yourself are on your way to oblivion. One of those nights, oblivion came calling.
On the periphery of the mainstream.
John got a hankering to try monkey brains.
That sort of thing.
I think the whole thing is a myth, perhaps an urban legend, not to mention downright ghastly, but I was both curious and drunk. And I was hanging out with John Lennon after all, so of course I was game. We went trotting drunkenly around these back streets looking for a place that served monkey brains. And we found a place, but it being late in the evening, they were closed. Which was probably for the best because we looked in through the windows and saw all these small tables with holes cut in them and my stomach just knotted up. John was pointing at the tables and explaining how they would put the monkey under the table and stick its head up through the hole. And while my imagination was just running away with me and I was thinking about what supposedly happens next once you get the monkey up through the table in the hole.
The honest idea.
These two guys inside the restaurant walked towards us and unlocked the door. Well, they knew it was John Lennon. And unlike those other times that he denied it, John fessed up. Yes, of course he was that John Lennon.
And the people responded.
They motioned for him to come inside. I tried to follow, but they shut the door in my face and made me wait. They were talking to John, but they were speaking in Cantonese. And I know for a fact that John didn't speak Cantonese. He was nodding along as if he understood. And then he followed them back into the back of the restaurant, the kitchen, I imagine. A few minutes went by. I started to panic. I didn't know who these men were. I didn't know what their plans were, their intentions. I didn't know why they wanted John. If he was being led to safety or danger.
Bamboozling.
They'd locked the door behind them, of course. So I paced and chain smoked outside. What else could I do?
And then we didn't see each other.
And then just a few minutes later, John emerged from the back room. One of the men walked him straight to the front door, unlocked it, and led him outside. John was beyond drunk. He was terribly high. He was grinning. He was grinning, but there was a look of consternation behind his smile, almost as if he wasn't happy that he was happy.
Very dramatic.
I asked him what had happened, what they'd done back there. He looked at me. We locked eyes.
Philosophical 2 o'clock in the morning.
His eyes were spinning, his lids were bobbing up and down like they were on a bungee cord. "The snake," he said, and his eyes went wild. "They had me drink the blood of a snake."
On the periphery of the mainstream.
I admit I was a bit jealous about that. Monkey brains? Not interested. Blood of a snake, I mean, come on, sign me up. And as stunned as he was, John could tell I wasn't hiding my disappointment well. He planned for it. He had returned with a gift. He told me to close my eyes. So I did. And then he told me to open my mouth. Which I did. Wider, he said. And then I felt something inside my mouth. It was cold and moist. I immediately regretted playing along.
He was from an art school.
John's hand shoved the gelatinous oval down my throat, so I swallowed. And then I nearly vomited it all back up. What the fuck was that? I asked, opening my eyes.
Bamboozling.
The taste of sulfur and dirt and ammonia coated my tongue. He told me it was a 1,000-day-old egg. It was just the name, it wasn't actually 1,000 days old, but it was an egg that had been cooked in horse urine, coated in manure, and buried in the fucking ground for a few days. Why someone would do that is beyond me. And how John knew so many details about precisely how the egg was prepared from men speaking a language he didn't speak is also beyond me. But then, John was beyond me.
So why an artist wants to do things in the first place?
I may have done well for myself in the years to follow, but I always felt the shadow of John Lennon looming. Over my shoulder. Near my feet. Now that was fame. The kind of fame that can be immortal in your mind. Even if, in real life, it proves to be deadly.
Los Angeles, January, 1976. Mal Evans' giant hands dwarfed the little Valium pills he held in his palm. They were so small, Mal was so big. He wondered whether they would even make a difference if he swallowed them. How could something so tiny have any kind of noticeable effect on a man of his size? He'd find out soon enough. Mal threw the pills into his mouth and chased them with whatever clear liquor was in the glass in his other hand. He felt woozy, groggy, and that was just the alcohol. Soon, those little pills would make their appearance after all, and that would be when everything Mal thought, said, or did just felt gooey. Mal's girlfriend, Fran, was worried. Mal seemed more despondent than usual. He wasn't making any sense. She called a friend. Mal picked up his .30-30 rifle, walked upstairs, and barricaded himself inside the bedroom of his rented duplex. That's when Fran called the police. Mal wasn't sure how he'd gotten here. He was a long way from London, years removed from Beatlemania, though he remembered those days like they were yesterday, because he was there just about every day. People called George Martin the fifth Beatle, or Billy Preston, but wasn't Mal Evans, jack of all trades and master of none, the true fifth Beatle? He'd been the lad's bodyguard, then road manager, then personal assistant. He helped put together the album cover collage of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. He sang in the chorus of Yellow Submarine. He rang the alarm clock during the sessions for A Day in the Life. He hit the anvil during the sessions for Maxwell's Silver Hammer. He produced No Matter What, one of Badfinger's biggest hits for Apple Records. That was then. This was now, and now wasn't so great. Where Mal had once again become a regular companion of his old friend John Lennon, during that period of time when John became a lone wolf resident of L.A., now Mal was alone again, naturally. John was gone, back to New York and presumably back to his wife, Yoko. Meanwhile, Mal's wife didn't want him anymore, and they were separated. She wanted a divorce. Mal thought that his friend Keith Moon would give him purpose again. Mooney hired Big Mal to produce his solo album, Two Sides of the Moon, But MCA Records fired Mao when it became apparent that Moon's wild antics and Mao's excessive drinking were going to yield less than desirable results. And so, now, Mal Evans was holed up inside a bedroom at 8122 West 4th Street in L.A. He didn't remember how many Valium he'd taken, or how many drinks he'd had, or why exactly he was holding the .30-30 rifle in his hands. He heard voices coming from downstairs. It was more than just Fran and a friend that she had called. Mal heard 4, 5, maybe 6 different voices. And then Mal heard footsteps. They were coming up the stairs. He checked the chamber of the rifle and realized that it wasn't loaded. Probably for the best. Mal Evans may have been a lot of things, but he wasn't the type to shoot a man. The LAPD cops who burst into the bedroom didn't know this about Mal. They didn't know that Mal's rifle wasn't loaded, and also didn't know that Mal wouldn't fire the damn thing if it was. The cops were armed, and there were two of them. And they pointed their police-issued .38s at Mal's big frame. "Put it down! Put the weapon down!" they both yelled. Ultimatum in stereo. Mal just stood there, holding the unloaded rifle, his hands gone gooey on the long, cold barrel, his head numbed by pills and alcohol. Mal couldn't feel the rifle in his hands. He couldn't feel anything as he moved his body to one side and absentmindedly aimed the butt of the rifle squarely at the cops. He did hear the 6 gunshots as they rang out from the cops' police-issued .38s. But he never felt the 4 bullets enter his body. Back in New York City, John Lennon heard about Mal Evans' unexpected and untimely death at the age of 40. Like the rest of the Beatles and just about everyone else who knew Mal, John was gutted. The death of the Beatles' manager, Brian Epstein, in 1967 had been tragic, especially for John. But Mal's death was more than tragic. Was violent, twisted. John thought back to the day in L.A. when he himself hid from the LAPD on the second floor of an apartment, how they had chased him upstairs, shotguns locked and loaded, how close John Lennon's life came to ending in the same way Mal Evans' life had ended. It was shocking. But what shocked John even more was the news that he received just days later. The phone inside John and Yoko's apartment at the Dakota Building rang out. John was no longer paranoid that the U.S. government would be waiting on the line to listen in to his every conversation. Nixon had resigned. John's phones were no longer bugged. In just a matter of months, he'd receive his green card and become an American once and for all. John answered the phone. It was Neil Aspinall, the Beatles' former road manager, personal assistant, and later manager of Apple Corps, calling from London. John could hear the fear and concern in Neil's voice all the way across the Atlantic as he frantically told John that Mal's remains had gone missing. Mal had been cremated in Los Angeles, after which Harry Nilsson had been tasked with mailing Mal's ashes back to his wife and mother in London. Harry put the ashes in the box just like he put the lime in the coconut, and then he sent them on their trip abroad. But they never arrived. There was no record that they had ever existed. Big Mal had vanished, just like that. And Neil Aspinall and John Lennon and all the others were left behind to wonder what had happened, why it was that one day someone was here and the next they were gone, and then how just days after that their memory was gone too. The thing they had left behind, no trace, no blood on the tracks. All right, everybody, thanks for listening to Blood on the Tracks. If you like what you hear, be sure to find and follow Blood on the Tracks on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. On this season 2 of Blood on the Tracks, we'll be releasing 10 episodes on the incredible life of John Lennon, with a new episode every Thursday. You can also binge all 10 episodes of season 1 on the insane story of the notorious record producer Phil Spector. Right now, it's available wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of Blood on the Tracks was written by Zeth Lundy and hosted and executive produced by me, Jake Brennan. Also executive produced by Brady Sadler. Story and copy editing by Pat Healy. This episode was mixed by Colin Fleming. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker. And this episode featured Rob Kendrick as David Bowie. Blood on the Tracks is produced by Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the Blood on the Tracks series page. If you want to chat about this show or hear more about the other shows we're making at Double Elvis, tap in on Instagram at Double Elvis, on Twitter at Double Elvis FM, and now on Twitch, where we're streaming 3 days a week at twitch.tv/Double Elvis Podcasts. And finally, be sure to check out Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I also host. Disgraceland is available only on the free Amazon Music app. To hear tons of insane stories about your favorite musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly, go to amazon.com/Disgraceland, or if you have an Echo device, just say, "Alexa, play the Disgraceland podcast." Rock and roll.